because he is our host, that is, and he decided to allow us to impose on him this week to be the host, because Brad McKay, who is usually the host, is having some family emergency and couldn't come. And Dustin is such a gentleman and a charmer, and I just literally want to say to thank him for stepping up into this moment, and I learned a lot.
Publicly, stage how it moved him, the lines it selected above of the nominees. It's a moment of storytelling, of oral tradition. Say to your peers, remember this. Tell others about this. Never forget this. The only thing not to like about the Writer Awards is that I can never win one. As an American. Which is racist. But as an American who loves Canada, who loves Canadians in general, and Canadian comics in particular, nothing makes me wish I was Canadian more than the Doug Bradley Awards. I'm proud and honored. This will reply.
That's me.
To be a part of them this year, and I look forward to many years of them in the future. So, let's get to it. And now I'm going to switch to the Holy Scripture of Rabbi Kai, which means there are going to be some dad jokes in here. Or all bad jokes. It's actually quite good, I think. I'd like to welcome you, let's pretend you're Brad, to the 12th Annual Award Ceremony. As is our long-standing tradition, I'd like to introduce you to the nominees for the 2016 Doug Rider Awards, who will then join me on stage to be publicly honored. Where it belongs. Another perhaps for Mr. Doug Wright. involved in putting on the awards, and sponsors including TCAP, the Marriott, Bugatti, Smiling Guy Studios, Danny Silverthorn, Deanna Tamlin, Rachel Richmond, Alex Coe, Betty Lang, Pete Berkman, Betty Lang again, Danny Trigon, Peggy Burns, Chris Oliveras, Andy Brown, Chris Pusher, Miles Baker, Ehab Rafe, G. Peter, Justin Brown, and Jerry Chitrick. Ken, Bill, and Jim Wright, Doug's sons, who have been very supportive from day one. Please give them a round of applause as well. There's no way we can do it without you. I expect that the big callers would be elected. Let me just explain these awards really quickly. We have three categories which recognize comics-based work and graphic novels published in the 2015 calendar year. The nominating committee, which is Jerry Chikarudy, Betty Leanne, Sean Rogers, and Alex Hoffman, responsible for creating a short list in each category. First is the Best Book Award, which recognizes the best single work for graphic novel in 2015. Second is the Doug Wright Spotlight Award, also known as the NIPR, which features talent deserving of wide recognition. Published in 2015. The winners of both these categories received the Doug Wright Award Trophy, which is designed by internationally acclaimed cartoonist Seth, who's also a co-founder and organizer of the awards. And lastly, there's the Pigskin Peters Award, which recognizes the best in non-narrative, experimental, avant-garde comics published in 2002. Named after a popular character in the seminal comic strip Bird's Eye Center, a Canadian cartoonist Jimmy Fries, the award is a tip of the hat to non-traditional work that, despite being offbeat or unique, deserves recognition. And the award reflects this by itself being unique. In fact, it is a hat, a boulder, as famously known by Pigskin himself. All three winners also receive a custom-bound version of their book, Plus Terry. These winners are decided by a jury, which this year features cartoonist Maurice Velter, Globe and Mail columnist Natalie Atkinson, and Emily Donaldson, editor-in-chief of Canadian Notes and Queries. Each year we also induct Canadian cartoonists into the Janus of the North, our Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame. And I guess at this point I can go ahead and introduce the first award. We'll get this thing done. Let me split. Presenting the Pigskin Peters Awards, Chris Kuzma, who's a cartoonist, illustrator, and teacher, and Spiff Dude from Toronto. He co-curates the Live His Own Small Press Room at TCAP. Chris was a Doug Wright Award nominee. That's a great title.
The artist's follow-up leather vest plays with another member of the X-Men, Storm. In most hands, Storm is redefined as an iconoclastic figure of gender and racial politics, thanks to the artist's forceful illustrations and clever aphorisms. Thank you. New comics, number 6 and 7, by Patrick Kyle. No one takes comics apart and puts them back together again with Patrick Kyle. His ongoing series called New Comics serves as his workshop. One project in his pages might find a madly drawing the foliage of an overgrown garden, while another has a measuring out the austere lines of high concept gallery art. Kyle's new comics is very restless and always invigorating. This is his 4th Red Awards nomination. Intelligent Sentient by Luke Ramsey. Ramsey's debut book features wordless, intricate, full-page illustrations that tell the story of a mysterious race of giants. Featuring occasional collaborations with other cartoonists, Intelligent Sentient wanders playfully through the epochs of the deep past and explores the technologies of a potential future.
Because they so vividly live Rochester Comics, and that's at Science Laboratory, the Ring of Robots, the Draculas, and Magical Fungi, called Curious Adventures for Pushes at the Extreme Boundaries of the Forum. Pages of flow with Walmart thinking, or also our empty event dates at Straight Readers Appliance. One issue comes printed on Sheen's print while the next is pasted in the Rising Craft. A story abruptly stops midway for a catalog of objects covered with rolls by the A from Mouse Beauty's drawing to themselves. Characters proclaim that they're not who you think. Walking typeface gives away to glowing handwriting. Abstract paintings abruptly take over the proceedings. No matter what the experiment, he's busy concocting how the pile makes comics that are unpredictable, florid, and bizarrely funny. For all of these reasons and many more, the nominating committee has chosen to recognize the remarkable Patrick Kyle. Congratulations.
This year marks the 20th anniversary of Conundrum Fest. Here, with an appreciation of publisher Andy Brown, is Joe Olman, who is a cartoonist from Hamilton. Best known for being a very sexy grandpa.
Thank you.
Now, to present the Denver Spotlight Award, I'd like to give my friend, Maddie McDonald, who is the editor-in-chief of The Geek, one of comics' oldest and best websites dedicated to comics, news, and discussion. She is a one-man opera.
Continue the American takeover. Seriously, so thrilled. I've learned so much about Canadian cartooning, Canadian culture by coming to these awards, so I'm really actually very honored to be a part of it. So, in the Nipper, to honor emerging talent, of which there's so much here to cast. So, without any further ado, the finalists for the 2016 Spotlight Award are Funny Ha Ha's by Ted Kudlow. And full-page illustration, Ted Kudlow's debut book is a part storm comedy and part dark introspection. Talking animals stumble through a hedonistic city full of alien invasions, sinister infomercials, utter destitution, and all-around fun times in Kudlow's first The Thunder Right Award nominated comic. Don't Get Eaten by Anything by Dakota Bethesda. While Bethesda was a student at the Center for American Studies, these daily comic strips have matured over time in both structure and subject. These colorful off-the-cuff panels provide an unpredictable sampling of what goes through the artist's mind in any given 24-hour period. This is Bethesda's second of regular comic. Mom Body. With good humor and a sense of awe, Toronto cartoonist Rebecca Rohr helps readers understand all the changes a woman's body undergoes when she's having a baby. Mom's Body is inspired by the experience of Rohr's good friend, but the artist's portrayal of motherhood comes off as universal, finely detailed, and inspiring. This is Rohr's first Dove Writer Award nomination. Body by Sabrina Scott. Witch Body outlines Sabrina Scott's personal, spiritual, and ecological ideologies through a combination of philosophy, ritual, and the comic book form. Starting as a master's degree thesis, Witch Body is an ambitious examination of how ethical, political, and mystical theory translate to physical practice. This is Scott's first Writer Award nomination. And finally, Tower Climb by Kat Verhoeven. Set in St. Jamestown, high-rise neighborhood in Toronto's downtown core, Tower Climb tells the story of a looming apocalypse and young people who see it coming. With a keen sense of curiosity, Verhoeven explores the uniqueness of the neighborhood's its history and its residents. This is Verhoeven's first Writer Award nomination. Of the 2016 Doug Wright Spotlight Award, the Nipper is Dakota McFadden.
Earlier this week, I was going out of town
for work and had a bunch of comics I needed to do, and Laura scrapped Planetary Chess with my son and went to the print shop and printed a bunch of comics for me so that I could have them here at TCAP. And she also did that 10 years ago when I started making comics. I went to the print shop and something went wrong, and you know, she showed up with two smoothies and thought everything was going great, and it wasn't. And she immediately like, put the smoothies down and like, didn't help me. So I really couldn't do 90% of what I do without Laura. So thanks very much, Laura. Thanks very much, Andy. Thanks to all my friends and family and teachers, and I really appreciate it.
James Simpkins has always been a personal favorite of mine.
When he died in 2004, the National Post asked me to write an obituary for him. What follows is a slightly altered form of an obituary. I think it's safe to say that Jasper the Bear was Canada's most recognizable cartoon character of the 20th century. Just how well known he is today is debatable. Certainly, if you are over 50 or live near Jasper Park, you will instantly know his face. However, I suspect he's fading away from younger generations. That's a shame, really. He was a character with a lot of quiet charm about him, much like his creator, James Simpkins. Simpkins was part of a small group of cartoonists, mostly starting out in the 1950s, who helped define the young pop culture of Canada. Peter Wally, Doug Wright, Len Norris, Walter Ball, Jimmy Fries. These names are fading away as their work grows dusty on the shelves of neglected secondhand humor sections. This shows that this was written a few years ago. There are no secondhand humor sections. Canada's homegrown media was small in those days, and our pop culture was still fresh and relatively undefined. Looking back, you can see that those involved made a concerted effort to create a Canadian pop culture that was separate and identifiable from that of Mother Britain or from the American neighbors to the south. The cliched images of Canada that we all roll our eyes at today were just then taking concrete shape during the decades of the 30s and the 60s. It was in his generation that all those mounties and beavers and lumberjacks and gap-toothed hockey players were being converted from folksy images into fully streamlined archetypes by the use of the modern gag cartoon. Jasper himself was a part of this phenomenon, created via Canadian image, but with a modern sensibility, meant to avoid the saccharine sweetness of previous kitty-friendly animal characters. Jasper was cheeky, self-possessed, and he was something of an absurd con man as well. He first appeared in the pages of Maclean's magazines on November 15, 1948, and ran weekly for more than 30 years. In short order, he became a familiar face on the Canadian landscape and was popular enough to generate warehouses full of merchandising. Cups, figures, inflatables, coloring books, dolls, pins, banks, you name it. You can still purchase a Zippo lighter with his image on it today. There were also several popular book collections of his cartoons and a newspaper comic strip that ran for a few years in the 1960s. People forget just how popular gag cartoons were back before the 1970s. We only see them in the New Yorker today, but back then every magazine had them, and there were thousands of magazines across North America. Simpkins was a freelance gag cartoonist, and that meant he worked wherever there was work. And in those days, before Federal Express, fax machines, scanners, or email, this meant he was mostly tied to the Canadian print media, mostly Toronto. His cartoons appeared in the Plains, Weekend, The Standard, Family Herald, The Montrealer, just about any old Canadian magazine you can dig up. He was obviously prolific, having produced a large body of cartoon work. It was undoubtedly hard work, too. He tried coming up with 30 years of gags without a bear. Canada was a pretty small market back then, and he must have pushed himself hard to make a good living for his family of five children. But looking at the drawings themselves, he obviously took real pleasure in the work. The cartoons are always wonderfully rendered, well-designed, full of life, and clearly show the sign of a hand that enjoyed drawing them. The gag cartoon was a strange, subtle little form, difficult to master. It's not as easy as it looks. Everything depended on a single drawing and a single line of text. A small, frozen incident, sketched out, at which the viewer gazed, often perplexed, for just a second. Then the eyes dart down, they take in that explaining line of dialogue, and all is clear. All this in hope of conjuring a tiny little humorous spark in the mind that will be generally forgotten moments later. The whole production dare not feel labored. The drawing had to be breezy and pleasant to look at. The humor, quick, matter of fact, off the cuff. If it smacked of effort or made you think about it too much, it failed. And you had to produce hundreds of these little visual puzzles a year and make a living, all just for the reader's momentary diversion. Like I said, hard work. I first came across Simpkins' cartoons as a child in the pages of Canadian Boy magazine, the house organ of the Boy Scouts of Canada. He drew a cute little beaver cartoon in there titled Chopper that was a real favorite of mine. I copied those drawings of his over and over again, and that was a big part of my early education as a cartoonist. I spent many years tracking down those old magazines so I could once again study those cartoons. They are extremely sweet cartoons. They're part of a different era than the one we live in now. I've made that sentence a couple of times. The last being when writer Red McKay and I went out to visit him at his retirement home in Dundas, Ontario. We were doing some research for a possible book on Canadian cartoonists in the past, and we wanted to ask him a few questions. As soon as we arrived, it was apparent we were in the right place. The elevator and the entire floor were papered with Xeroxes of his cartoons. What I didn't know then is that he was photocopying his old cartoons, carefully coloring them, and posting them up around the building. Upon entering his room, we immediately saw that it was similarly wallpapered with cartoons and photos. The souvenirs of the careers of cartoons were everywhere. A large photo of Pierre Trudeau hugging an oversized Jasper dominated the room. In the corner was a drawing table that was clearly still being used, probably to cover those photocopies. For a man in his 90s, he was in wonderful shape. Trim, well-dressed, obviously still very able. After some brief preliminaries, I launched into my questions. It didn't take long for me to realize that his memory was not up to the task. After a few more attempts to pry out some answers, I put my 87 type questions aside and decided to simply enjoy the opportunity to sit and talk with him. He was exceptionally charming that day. He never once stopped smiling, except perhaps when his memory failed him. I asked him when he retired, and like a true freelancer, he answered, "Oh, I haven't retired. I'm still shopping a few things around." Just before we left, he reached up and pulled down an object from a high shelf. "Look what I found for my grandchild," he said. It was a large golden plastic crown, and after holding it out for us to admire, he gently placed it on his own head. With a broad grin on his face, he flipped a switch on the side of the crown, and unexpectedly, tinny electronic music began to play. This is how I will always remember James. As we walked up to the car afterwards, I thought about the paths in life and how they take you to strange places. I thought of myself as a child, copying out those chopper cartoons at the kitchen table, and how they had led me to the door of this old man. He had no idea, I'm sure, that when he drew those ephemeral drawings back in the early 60s, more than 30 years later, someone would still be thinking about them. And I'm still thinking about them today, 10 years after I wrote that obituary. In fact, a few years ago, when I wrote my imaginary comics history, The Great Northern Brotherhood of Canadian Cartoonists, I couldn't resist casting Simpkins as the long-standing president of the made-up club. I didn't draw him in the book, but I should have, and I should have drawn him with the crown on. Instead, today I have the pleasure of inducting his memory into the Giants of the North Cartooning Hall of Fame, and I'd like to welcome his grandson, Kevin Boyle, to accept the medal for him.
He would have just scribble on. A big part of his life was cartoon, and Jasper the Bear in particular. That occupied a big part of his life. And so it took me a while to realize what a special talent it is to tell a story that made people laugh using a single frame drawing or quote. Humor and its byproduct, laughter, is one of the greatest gifts we can share with each other. It's a gift that my grandpa left to his kids and grandkids and many others who enjoy his work. On behalf of my family, my grandfather, I'd like to thank you, everyone who supported the Wright family, for this deeply special honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lucky may have heard at the show this week that Darwin Cook got it today. Darwin always supported PCAF, and he was at every PCAF, I think. And he was at the very first February Awards as well. Darwin was a very big figure. I think we might have been exactly the same age, actually, Darwin and I. And he was an enormously talented person. That's kind of almost beside the point. That's the first thing he knew about anything that he did. He didn't even have to like his work to know he was enormously talented. Darwin and I had a lot in common, I always felt. I thought we were very similar types. He was a real talker. He talked a lot. He was very opinionated. Our aesthetics were extremely similar. We had a lot in common. So, of course, we didn't like each other. We didn't get along at all. In fact, the very first time I met him was many years ago at some event at the Rivoli. I was with Chester Brown and Joe Matt, and Darwin barged up and flopped down at our table. I didn't know who the hell he was. And he immediately said, he said to Joe Matt, he said, "I want my money back." He said, "I just bought your comic book, 24 pages, and nothing happened." And he said it with a lot more obscenities than I just said. And I was immediately picked up my back up. Joe Matt, nobody attacked Joe Matt but me. So I was like, I don't like this guy. And for years, we were very distant after that. But this year, just in November, I believe, Chris Butcher invited myself to go to Kendal, to in England, to do a little Canadian sort of intervention in their show. And he invited me and my wife Tanya, and Chris was there with his husband Andrew, and Kate Eaton was there, and Michael LaForge, and the Immermans were there, and Darwin and his wife Marcia. And I wondered, going there, like, well, it's time to deal with Darwin. I'm going to have to be with him. And the interesting thing was I had a great time. Darwin and I really connected on that trip. He was very mouthy and inappropriate. I would say even pushy. And these are qualities I respect. And he attacked me several times. And we went head to head. And I remember at one point he said possibly the thing that's hurt me the most. I was talking on and on, and he said to me, "Take a breath, huh?" But you know what? I really liked him tremendously on that trip. He was had some quality about him, actually, even at that age, he was a grand old man. He was very working class in his sensibilities, and I related to that. We had very shared, and our aesthetics were so close, and we talked very much about that. And I had no idea he was ill. And I thought that was the beginning of possibly a friendship, maybe an odd friendship, but I thought I would see him around for years at conventions, and I was looking forward to many more drunken nights together with him. And so when I heard he was dying, I was very upset. I thought about this all day yesterday, while I was out talking and joking around with people, that he was going through his last hours. And I, you know, I don't know if I believe in an afterlife, but I often think and talk about that like we all have probably one perfect moment in our lives, and hopefully I always think maybe you get to live within that moment after you're gone. So I wish that for you, Mr. Cook, and I also wish that I discovered earlier how much I like you. Rest in peace, Darwin.
She is interested
any recognition at all. Nonetheless, please give it up for Betty Lang.
She won the Emerging Talent Award in 2009. Strumpy by Mark Bell. Mark Bell's career straddles the worlds of fine art and alternative comics. Strumpy combines the two in a big-footed graphic novel whose pages could easily hang in a fine art gallery. The title character, Strumpy, sets out to win the All-Star Schnauzer Band's song contest, embarking on an absurdist journey that allows Bell to let joyfully loose. This is Bell's sixth nomination. He won the Pigskin Peters Award in 2010 for his book Hot Potato. Dressing by Michael DeForge. Dressing gathers a number of Michael DeForge's mini-comics and short stories from recent years into one meticulous collection. In addition to the atmosphere and off-kilter wit found in his longer projects, these shorter subjects are also infused with a sense of weird variety and spontaneity. This is his 10th Writing Awards nomination. He has won twice for Best Emerging Talent and in the Pigskin Peter categories. Melody by Sylvie Roncourt. Appearing in English for the first time this year, Sylvie Roncourt's Melody comics remain every bit as groundbreaking, fearless, and surprisingly sunny as they were back in the 1980s. Her autobiographical stories of strip clubs, orgies, and petty crime in down-and-out Montreal are intimate and personal, while her cartooning is unadorned, intuitive, and winningly bright-eyed. This is Roncourt's first Write Award nomination. Palookaville number 22 by some guy named Seth. The latest installment in Seth's long-running comic series may be the most somber and striking one to date. The Lupinville number 22 features a thoughtful meditation on childhood memories from Seth's personal diary, a photo essay on a barbershop designed by the artist, and a surprisingly caustic new chapter in his Clive Band story. This is Seth's sixth DWA nomination. He has won two Best Book Awards. Super Mutant Magic Candy by Jimmy Tonight. Originally published online, Super Mutant Magic Academy is equal parts Hogwarts, X-Men, and Gillian Mackey's own ironic take on adolescence. In this celebrated collection, the ensemble cast of weirdos and outcasts journeys through love, loss, and self-discovery with all of the humor, tragedy, and romantic bewilderment of the best high school dramas. This is Tamaki's fifth nomination. She has won once in 2009 for co-creating graphic novel Skin. And the winner of the 2016 Best Book Award is Dressing by Michael DeForge.
Consistently developing a fresh and often unconventional color palette and strategy.
Even a loose sketchbook draft demonstrates an artist's incredible storytelling, showing restrained pacing to dole out powerful, poignant, and perfectly timed beats. It's a work of outstanding and exciting originality. Congratulations.
Well, that's it. There are a couple of things, I believe, the Beguiling is Selling Books by the nominees outside. Is that right, Peter? Brandon, right there, that table is suspiciously empty. also, G, I need to mention that there will be a wake for Darwin in the next week or a week? You know.
Roughly a week now.
And so, if you're connected to the Beguiling in any way, things like media or whatever, just keep an eye out. Attending that. I'd like to thank all the jurors, the nominees, Lois McKean, the guy, two cast staff, Phyllis. I also personally feel very thankful for the Double Eye Awards. It's super mentioning that. And TCAP. We've lost people this year, but it feels good that there's a place for the new people to find recognition, support. And at home.